Hey everyone, this episode is with Marco Pinotti. This one was awesome. If you love training science and just nerding out on detailed training stuff and sports science, you're gonna love this one. Marco is an Italian ex-pro cyclist and was one of the best time trialists from the generation I grew up watching. He's now a coach on Jake Oulula, and what he really loves and focuses on the most with the team is optimizing the time trial and the team time trial for the team. Marco has published so many papers, blog posts, written a book, and put out so much amazing content on cycling and training over the years. I grew up reading a lot of it, trying to learn. So I tried to keep this podcast to all new information to build on what's already out there. So I hope if you like this kind of content, this will all be new stuff for you. So I hope it's just full of gems. Specifically, we focused a lot on time trialing in this episode. So if that's interesting for you, this is probably the most dense source of TT training advice out there. If you love this type of content and want more, you can check out my books at howtobecomeaprocyclist.com. And if you're new to the show, there's no ads. The whole point is just to provide free information about cycling, training, and sports science from the best riders and coaches in the world. All right, enjoy the show.
Okay, cool.
Hey, nice to see you face to face.
Nice to see you too. I've been reading your content for so many years. I was reading like blog posts on Training Peaks by Marco Pinotti when I was starting as a junior.
Okay.
It's very cool to ask you questions. Yeah. How's the start of the season been?
Yeah. Well, I would say it's been up and down, I was thinking, because we had a good start in Australia and then an average tour down under with some luck. And then Simon Yates were able to win Saudi, which was an important race for us. And now we had a streak of a little bit bad luck with injuries, with rather some accidents. So we have had up to eight riders currently out at the same moment for injuries or sickness.
Sure.
So it's been a bit of a struggle to make sure we had. We were able to go to all the races with the competitive team.
Sure.
So far.
What are the most common injuries?
Yeah, but overall, the most common is, unfortunately, is an injury caused by a crash. Mm-hmm.
So, like, let's just say, like a.
The most common one is not the overuse injuries or overload injuries. Unfortunately, it's what happened in the race. So we had others maybe crashed out that. In the race or in training, you know, we had one man and one woman hit by a car recently in training. Yeah. So that took him out in competition. One less serious, luckily. The other more serious, so the rider would be off racing for 3 months or something.
Oh, horrible.
And yeah.
What is?
Yeah. We know it's a dangerous sport, but if it happened in the race, okay, we can accept that, but when it happens in training, especially if it's not the rider's fault, it's not.
For sure.
Yeah, it's not the
best. So let's say, because injuries are so diverse, like everything is so specific, but let's say like a broken collarbone, for example, or a broken arm, like those are really common. What sort of things do you guys do to help speed up the recovery a little bit there? So a normal person breaks a bone and they just put it in a cast for 6 weeks and then they see the doctor. What do you guys do to make it faster?
It's a very, very different approach. That's why we rely on a doctor, either internal or external to the team, that have experiences working with sport people. Otherwise, like you said, you know, the standard advice to the average person can cause more harm than good to a normal person, because maybe they would say, stay off for 9 weeks. Offload for 9 weeks, but then you lose all the muscle mass, all the. So it's a very generic advice. So we try on one side, the first thing is the health of the rider, okay? What is the best for him? And the second thing is the fitness level of the rider. So we try to balance out those things, okay? We had rider breaking collarbone, like you said, an example, the breaking collarbone. If it's off season, the rider stay off for 4 weeks. If it's during the season, you know, be on the rollers, even with the whatever, you know, system to keep the collarbone in place as soon as possible, as long as it doesn't hurt the recovery process.
Sure.
But we try to keep it active, and we do probably more physiotherapy work. Sports people do more physiotherapy work just to keep the muscle able to move and to keep the range of motion and to make sure there is the minimum impact in the future. So you have less imbalances, that's not right. So this stuff, I think, a normal person, maybe they say go to physiotherapist twice a week, and then we try to do every day. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what we do is like give that level of support that is able to get back the riders back in competition as soon as possible.
Sure.
But keeping in mind the health of the rider is the first priority.
Yeah. Of course, I'm just...
But usually it's the opposite. So it's us, the team, slowing down the rider because the rider just want to get back. It's competitive people in sports, and so they want to go back. They want to be themselves. They feel themselves as soon as possible. Like, normally we have to, balance that win with what is common sense. Everybody wants the rider to be back again, but there is some step that goes forward. With a broken bone, it takes a certain amount of time to heal. There's no shortcut.
Yeah. Well, I'm just thinking because I broke my pelvis in the middle of the 2022 season, and I was rushing to do everything to try to heal it faster. And so I tried everything I could think of. From like, I even did a couple of sessions in a hyperbaric chamber. I was taking more collagen. I tried taking more protein. I was using a grounding wire. Like, I don't know if you know what grounding or earthing is. Like, it sounds like a really hippie.
Yeah, I love it.
I think it's great. I did that. But I really think the thing that helped me the most was just getting blood flow, like getting back on the bike as soon as possible. Even just...
Yeah. Because I had some experience, I broke my pelvis twice. So I have some experience with that. And I remember, when I came back to the office, they said, off 3 months. Yeah. Okay. No lower for 3 months.
Yeah, 6 days.
But then after 4 weeks, because it gets, and then during the 4 weeks, I was doing magnetotherapy every day or every night with the tool that you rent.
What therapy?
Maybe they give you.
What type of therapy?
Magnetotherapy. You took a solenoid around the leg and you put it into the electricity and it generates waves.
Okay.
That helps a little bit. Basically, it helps the blood flow around.
What's
so
it called?
It fastened the healing.
Solenoid training?
Magnetotherapy.
Magnetic therapy. Yeah, okay. Magnetotherapy.
No, it's like, just basically through a magnetic field and an electronic field, it helps the bone or the heel, but basically improve the blood flow around the area that needs more blood flow to get the nutrients and everything.
Okay.
So you try. You have nothing to do. You tried everything to do that, and then you try to do exercises with the upper body. But after 4 weeks, I was going on the bike, not outside, but I was going on the roller because once the load was gone, actually the doctor said it's good to keep the head there because the movement helps the healing process itself.
Yeah.
The only problem is if you crash again too early, that is not the bone is not healed. Is if you crash again, that's why you don't go out. But you just stay indoor.
Yeah, I found that's exactly how I found it. And out of all the crazy things I tried, like to try to heal it faster, I really think the thing that did it the fastest was getting back on the bike. Like just, I don't think your body knows the difference between recovering from training and recovering a broken bone. So all these systems that happen in your body when you finish a training ride that just heal to recover, I think it helped to heal the bone faster. I don't know. Maybe that's just in my opinion.
Yeah, and also, we notice it when a rider break a bone, to heal the bone, it takes some energy. So, that's why you feel more tired soon. Okay, that's another other stuff going around, but you feel you don't feel the same because, it's like when you're a little bit sick, so that the bone is working toward healing the part of itself. So, it cannot perform at the same level, but, it can perform at some level.
Was there anything else that you found that worked really well other than the magnetic therapy?
To come back as soon as possible.
Yeah.
Well, I think nutrition was important because you have to change nutrition quite dramatically because you go from burning, 3,000-4,000 kilojoule extra to burn to just basic level. So and your hunger takes a while to adapt. Probably you reduce all the carbohydrates you take, you reduce all the quantity. You maintain the protein, you want to increase a little bit. And then, so through this tricky nutrition, you are able to lose as minimal as possible muscle mass, because you're going to lose that, and do not put a lot of muscle mass. So when you are back, you don't have, you need to gain the muscle mass. So you probably are lighter when you are back. You gain muscle mass back, but you don't have to work again, put an extra stress of body to lose a lot of body fat.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's so, exactly what I found, yeah. Because you try to, taking in the extra protein, if maybe it helps you heal quicker, but also just to keep you, so you're not hungry, so you're not smashing so much carbs
would. So there's been a few times in my career I was counting calories. One was when I was injured with a broken pelvis, because I was counting calories and counting protein to make sure I think it was 140 grams of protein every day, but you know, within 2,000 kilocalories a day, not more.
Okay.
And then I was able, when I came back, okay, you still feel fine on the bike, you know, you don't feel fat, okay, or too big.
Yeah, okay. We should have actually said this at the beginning. What is your role at Jayco right now?
Well, so I cover multiple places, but basically the one that keep you busy the most up to role, one is I take care of equipment. So alliance with our sponsor and the mechanic, I'm the connection between the two to basically explain our partners, the team needs for each race, and then balance that with the request of that we have the team with what the partner can give us in terms of mechanics of clothing or other stuff. And then I coach rider. And then when it comes to time trial, I am the one that prepare the team in the race for a time trial, the last day or the last 2 days approach.
Yeah.
So usually when there's a time trial, I go almost all the races on site, and then I lead the day for the time trial, prepare basic strategy, discuss equipment. Yeah. During that day.
Yeah. Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about, because you were exceptional in the time trial. So I really want to ask you very specific questions on this.
Yeah, probably the thing that made keep me busy the most are the other two, but the thing that I love the most is just when I go to a race and lead the team in a time.
Okay, let's talk about that event. Then. So yeah. what do you think? So obviously you looked at everything during your career, because you had, I can't even remember how many national titles, six national titles time trial? What is different now? What are guys focusing on now that you weren't focusing on then? Because I imagine during your career, you were already doing everything perfect. What are they doing now that you weren't doing?
Well, I think at least the race day, I think the rider have more information about and a more precise basic strategy, really. Planned out to their physiological capabilities. Okay, I was more or less, because I could do that with myself, and now I can do that with the other, just knowing physiological data or their former experience. And before, I mean, the training for time trial itself has not changed, but training a lot. The training has changed a lot at that age, but also in time trial. And I know there's been a big development in equipment as usual, but this is just through a constant improvement.
Sure, yeah. The equipment's always getting better. So that's a pretty steady progression. Yeah,
it was getting better, but now maybe it took more dramatic step in the last 5-6 years, because you know people realize this aerodynamic is became more and more effective, and so it's not anything dramatically different. It's just that what I was doing has been refined, you know, because we have more information available, just more information.
Okay, so
from how about environmental information, physiological information, and you know, power data in general. So the pacing is much correct. Nobody. I mean, it's very rare now to you know, start too hard or completely.
Yeah, fuck yourself.
Plan the race in the wrong. Yeah, you know, fucked up in the race. Yeah. You know. It's very hard.
So, yeah. Okay. But so then I guess I'm curious about this for the pacing strategies then, because the fundamentals, the basics of pacing a time trial, don't go out too hard. That's the first one. When it's normally, I guess it depends on the course a little bit.
Yeah, it depends on the course. If it's a headwind on the way out and tailwind on the way back, you have to go out too hard.
Sure. So that's another one.
You know,
whenever it's slow on the course, you typically push more. So when it's a headwind, uphill.
Yeah. The lower is the simple rule number one is the lower the speed, the higher the power.
Okay. Perfect. That's a great way to put it.
Very simple.
Is there anything else?
And then rule number two, we just follow number one, always, all the time. The lower the speed, the higher the power.
Okay.
You know, within this, so it means on a steep descent, there's no power. You don't need no power, you know, you just need a good skill. And on a very steep climb, you need a lot of power.
Yeah, okay. So who's...
So when you want to save energy, make sure you're going fast. The speed is high. Okay.
And then...
You know?
Are there things like... Who is the most talented time trialist you work with right now?
Right now? Yeah, we have just Blatt.
Okay.
Joining the team probably is the strongest hope to be
had. Okay. And then... When you're giving him...
And last year was probably, in the team, was probably Sobrero.
Okay. And then, so let's focus on Luke Platt then. So when you're giving him a pacing strategy, and again, if you don't want to say this, you can just tell me you don't want to say this on a podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
When you give him a pacing strategy, are you giving him specific numbers? Like push 450 here, push 380 here, push 420 here. Is it like that detail?
So in the case of a new rider in the team like he is, never, because I gave him a ballpark. I gave him a range, 10, 20 watts range.
Okay.
But this is, for him or generally for everyone. Because, and I've seen other pacing strategy from other teams or other sources, which they give not only 400, they give 407, or which for me, it doesn't make any sense because... It can easily be that the power meter has a tolerance of 2%. So it's 10 watts easily. And the rider might be on a bad day, on a very good day. Very rarely I see a rider hitting their personal best in a race. Okay. Very rarely, but it can happen. And it's never easy. 5% more. It's usually 1-2% more. So, but, you know, I give a pacing strategy and then just to give an rider, and most of the time the pacing strategy is just to tell him, for me, is to tell him, okay, this time trial lasts 35 minutes, okay? This section is 5 minutes, that section is 1 minute, that section is 8 minutes, okay? This 5 minutes up in, 2 minutes the same. And then a rider, especially, you know, a talented time trial. By talent, I mean not only physiological, but also in the mind, because they are a natural time trialer. I think it's a smart brain that can process the information itself and figure out himself the pacing strategy. So what I'm telling him is just a general idea. Okay, not general. Just, this is what I think you can do and what I think you should do. Okay. And then, you figure it out yourself. That's the advice that I would give to a TD specialist. A rider who doesn't know anything, I said, okay, try to do 410, 430, okay, and then you target 420, okay.
But so for everybody, you give about a 10 to 20 watt range for each segment?
Okay. Yes.
And then
for each segment, more or less.
Then how do you come up with these numbers? Because obviously you're not asking the rider to do a test 2 weeks before the race. Like, where do these numbers come from? I'm assuming not from the January training camp.
No. I mean, I study all the riders for the ride. Normally, I look at the riders for the whole year season, or look at all the power data. And then I look at more specifically the last 3 months or the last 90 days. And then I look where they passed or their, some of them have been, has been achieved. So let's say if I have a 20 minutes effort or a time trial of 50 kilometers, 20 minutes long, okay, I look okay, I predict the duration is 20 minutes. What is the best 20 minutes of the rider? And I look, okay, it's 400 watts. Where it has been achieved? Was a maximum effort? Was on a GT bike? Was on a road bike? And so I try to figure it out there. And it is not a maximum effort, which most of the time there is not such information. Then I try to figure out by, you know, basically looking at the rider and knowing himself, you know. It sounds simple, but it's not, because very rarely, you know, you find time trial. And then when was it achieved? In a stage race or in a... So basically, I look at the most recent data that are valuable. It's not... It's a bit like an art, I guess. It's most sometimes it's a guess, and then because it's not also the power is not constant, so it is. But basically, I look at the rider and I spend a good chunk of time looking at their own data, and then figure it out. And if they, for a lot of rider, I have a lot of tests, so I know W prime, critical power, and so you can plan that. Mm-hmm. And very recent, if not, You just keep it. It's a trial and error thing.
Sure. And so which tools do you use to work with your riders? Like Training Peaks, I'm guessing, is one. What else would you use?
Yeah, we use Training Peaks or any training data repository, okay? And then I use Best by Split to give me an idea of the duration and a suggested of the duration and a suggested. Best by Split is a very good tool because give you already an idea of how to distribute the power output on a course. And he has weather information already into that. So it's one in one piece I have a lot of stuff already. And but in the end, the final document I send down to the rider, I do it by myself, basically. Okay. Based on, and I try to keep it simple. So that could be a very straightforward course, or that could be a very complicated course. So you can divide it in 50 segments. But the human brain, under effort, doesn't remember a lot of things. So you have to keep it simple.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
Because sometimes the rider, I found that the rider says, remind me the radio watt power output, should I follow here? And I'm like, this is crazy. You saw the course, you should, but anyway, every rider is different. So sometimes they even remind me that. So that's why I don't like to give 15 different power outputs for different segments. Okay. I try to keep it. And I use a color screen, a traffic light system, like red, yellow and orange and green, so when they have to go harder and easy, so for them it's easier to remember.
Wait, do they have lights on the bike?
No, but when I give this document, it's mostly based on color. Okay.
So they hold the back visual or representation. Push?
Yeah.
You mean like, is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Okay, I got you.
Yeah.
Push it.
Yeah.
Okay. And then what are you talking to them in the radio during the race?
Yes. I mean, this is... I think this is very important, because when I was a rider, I've been able to do very good time trial. If I felt a good connection with the person talking the radio, okay. And I'll say I did bad time trial, but I did not give my best. Definitely, it was not when I had someone that doesn't know the course, just give me ale, just tell me just this one. Yeah. So every time I have new runner, I sit down with him, good time to talk. What do you want to hear on the radio? Okay. And most of the time, I don't know. Then this is what I will tell you. I will tell you this, that, and that. Okay. Are you okay with that? Or you want more information or less information? I try to develop a relationship with the rider that I follow. And, you know, I want to at the end of the year, that was great. Because I think with the right information at the right time, I am able to take the best out of everyone. Mm-hmm. You know, I found out when I just at home and give a business strategy, yeah, it's not the same. So I like to follow and talk with the rider. And I have also, for that, two, you know, a couple of simple rules that, one, I have two rules when I talk on the radio. One is never lie to the rider. So I never, never in my life told you are 10 seconds in front or when it's not. Okay. And the reason is simple, because the rider will find out if I lie. And the next time I talk to him, he will doubt me. If I tell you, oh, you are 30 seconds in front and you are, it's only 20. And if, so next time he's not going to believe me. And the rule number two, I try to keep always a positive, in a positive way. So even if I don't know, the rider is off the pace or is, you know, is big, is closer competitor, is ahead of him, I have to tell him, okay, this rider is 5 seconds in front of you. But now, blah, blah, blah. So I try to put in a positive way. Sometimes it's not possible. The rider is just having a bad day. So, you know, I try to do the best. I try to keep this to rule for every discussion I have.
Okay.
Every talk I have on the radio.
Okay. And analyzing power files is obviously quite straightforward. That's quite easy. It's easy to analyze power. It's easy to analyze aerodynamics. Do you do anything to analyze how fast a rider can corner in the time trial? Like if there's somebody that can takes a corner really fast or slow, is there any way to look at this?
Yes, I do, but it's very hard and it's very important to do it well. So what I do is I took it's very difficult to do in one corner, okay? But sometimes I try to record all the I have a camera with me,
okay,
and records all the riders I follow. I record, and then when I see a rider which I feel has lost a lot of time in the corner, I make a video with the parallel view, like with another rider on the side, screen to screen, mm-hmm, and then I show this to tell him, you know, so listen how this rider took the corner, how you took the corner. Okay. And when I look at the files, if I have not seen the rider, I normally look like at segments, okay, the most technical segment. For example, last year in I look at Strava to find out other riders' data. And also time, I remember last year in the world champion, you know, in national champ, there was a descent with 4 or 5 corner. So I timed Sobrero, and then I timed was another rider. So I you lost 9 seconds in this 3 kilometers descent. You know what 9 seconds are? And so, but it's very important because people will focus too much on time on aerodynamics. And no, I don't say we don't focus, but we don't pay enough attention to cornering skill. Mm-hmm. So, and these days courses are less and less straightforward. So it's very important. And normally I look like average speed of that segment. Okay. I don't look at the power. I just look at the speed. Okay. Because this is a real, you know, it is just a, power can be off. The power meter can be, not all are the same, but speed is normal. It's normally very precise. And so you figure out, okay, 300 meters before the corner, 200 meters after the corner. This I have an average speed of 44. The other one is 47. So it's 1.5 seconds again.
Yeah.
So because when I look at the corner itself, you don't lose a lot. It's very rarely. People say, you lose 1 second every corner. 1 second is a lot for every corner. 1 second is a lot. 1 second is a lot. But sometimes I just look at very simple data like, for example, when it's a long descent, I look at the maximum speed of different riders. They give me an idea of what, you know, some, and then you can find difference maybe up to 10 kilometers per hour. Some other have reached a peak of 72, other riders reach a peak of 82.
Interesting.
Or the lowest speed in a corner, the lowest speed in a switchback. You know, and I look at the data and, okay, this rider at the corner 36, this other 38. And this I found when I, maybe rather started with the wet road and the other one a dry road, there's massive difference.
Yeah, that's right.
5, 6, 7 kilometers per hour. But, you know, this, you know, is naturally.
Yeah. Are you guys on SRAM or Shimano?
Shimano.
I think you need to suggest to Shimano. It's like, hey, we need sensors in the brakes to measure braking forces like they have in Formula One. And then you can see who's braking the most, who uses the brakes too much.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good suggestion. Yeah. No, yeah, I didn't know Formula One has these braking forces, but yeah. But that doesn't necessarily correlate with good cornering, because sometimes, so you brake hard, but late. You brake last yeah. moment.
Well, you can see so all you keep that. The speed longer. You can see that. That would be cool. Okay. Like, you could see that stuff.
Okay.
That's interesting. Okay, so here's another question. If, let's say, Luke Plapp says he wants to target the Olympic time trial this year, and he has an...
Yeah,
exactly. What would you do in training with him for the 3 months leading up to that?
Well, he has his coach, so he's leading up to that. You know, what I care is more about giving him indication of what are the benchmarks to beat.
Okay.
To be competitive, you know, based on the data we collect during the season. Okay. So we got data from national championship. We collect data from all the races that he does, and then what he does in training. And then, you know, he just need to give the best of, because, okay, we just need to make sure that he is at his best of his capabilities during that day, so that his land and as it is his equipment, as it is you know, his last few days approach to the event. But, you know, the preparation is, you know, we know the length of the course. You need to be as fast as possible from kilometer zero to the end of the race. So basically, I don't look at much at his training, because he had his own coach. But when I align with the coach ever after the time to train and analyze the power he developed for after each one, and see if he's developing or is on a good path or is regressing.
Okay.
And what we need to adjust.
And so what are the benchmarks that you would give him? Is it literally like, okay, we imagine the race is going to be 45 minutes long. You need to be able to push 450 watts for 45 minutes? Or like, what's the...
Yeah. So, I mean, based on you, okay, what's your best there? It's 45 minutes. Oh, okay. You need to target 420 watts. Okay.
Okay.
Is that enough? Well, but we know Ghana can put... We estimate Ghana can put 480, okay? Well, is Ghana push 480? Well, there is no way to do that because of the nature of the course. But we try to, you know, we try to do the best of what we can control. Okay, we cannot control our competitor. You know, sometimes it's just a course that the power to weight doesn't count. It just counts absolute power. And Plapp is 70 kilo, Brianna is 84 kilo. So if he nails everything, he gets 50 watts more, mm-hmm. which correlates to blah 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 3 kilometers per hour more. So
okay. But that's really motivating when a rider hears like, okay, if I can do 420 for 45 minutes, I have a shot at a medal at the Olympics. That's really motivating.
Yeah. Normally, whenever you have a shot at that, yeah, it's okay. For top five, you need this. Mm-hmm. Okay. Based on what we've seen, maybe you arrive there and the rest of the rider boom just improve passively. It can happen. Mm-hmm. Or most of the time, it's like on an uphill finish.
Yeah.
Okay. An uphill finish. Today it was Andalusia individual time trial, 5.5 kilometers. So 9 minutes time. And literally it was 8 minutes, 15 seconds. You know, if you want to win, you need to have seven, you need to be light and you need to fit seven more watts per kilo.
Yeah.
So if you weigh 70 kilo, you have to line out the pacing strategy. And the mark is 70 kilo, 68, whatever. If he wants to win, I know he has to do 490 watts.
Hmm.
But his best 5 minutes for 16, so he's never going to win.
Yeah, you know? Okay. But is it that clear, though?
So I just say, okay, I give him a pacing strategy. Okay, you can hold for 8 minutes, you can hold for 20, okay? And then he did 410, or if he did 430, oh, that's great. But, you know, if he's 35 or 458, you know, but to win... Either you need if you weigh 60 kilo, you need to do 420 watts. So if you weigh 70, you need to do 470, 480.
Okay.
That kind of stops. And also on top of that, you need to ride in aero position, you know, even if it was on a road bike, you know, all the stuff. But this all the stuff have been done by everybody, mm-hmm. you know. You just need to have this amount of power for 10 minutes and distribute in a most efficient way.
Okay. And so I could ask you questions for the next 10 hours. This is fun. What about this? So I was always taught, like, I did a lot of these efforts where you would do low torque for, let's say, 4 minutes and then high cadence for the last 2 minutes. So it's a 6 minute effort and you do the first 4 minutes low cadence and then the last 2 minutes really high cadence. So let's say 60, 70 RPM for the first 4 minutes and then more than 100 RPM for the last 2 minutes. I didn't understand it. I just did it, but I'm assuming it's like something like teaching the muscles to work at a higher cadence. I don't know. Does this work? Do you do this?
Well, this is, yeah, this has been something that this cadence variation stats is probably, there's not really a lot of science behind it, to be honest. And my impression, especially also when I was a rider, people were prescribing this low cadence stuff, but the power was generally lower than that. So it's not enough to be called strength workout. Okay. It just get a variation. So I think it helps, you know, when you have lower cadence and the torque is higher, you recruit more
muscle fibers.
More fiber. Yeah. Okay. More muscle fibers. So I think it's, due to this variation, you work on different muscle fibers, okay? That's the principle behind. So you can keep longer. But in my mind, it's just a nice way to make the training less boring, okay?
Okay.
If they tell you, do 20 minutes and do 2 minutes, 2 minutes that, there's not a lot of, I don't think, this is my guess, not a lot of physiological difference than say, go 20 minutes steady. But it's boring, okay? Well, I found somebody's this passed quickly because they have to think, 1 minute this, then 1 minute again, and then 2 minutes located, and then 1 minute, you know. It's just a nice way to trick a bit the mind during a long workout.
Gotcha. Okay, so when you give, let's say, 5 times 4 minutes or 20 times 1 minute, it's just do that effort, and then it's just rest in between. You don't have to do some high cadence after each one. You don't do that.
No, naturally you go higher
of course,
cadence.
But it's not like prescribed. Because it's not like 120.
No. Just accept the cadence, which is normally 85 or 90. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Because if you look at the, it's a comfortable cadence. No, not at all.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Another interesting question for you, and this is a big topic, is the idea around inertia, like training at different speeds. Because the way, and you can tell me if I'm wrong on this, but this is how I think about it. Is like if you do all your training on a climb, you might be able to push whatever 450 watts on a climb, but if you try to do it on the flats, you can't push the same kind of watts because the way the muscle fires at 8 kilometers an hour compared to 40 kilometers an hour is different.
Yeah.
And the way I've always thought about it, like if I was giving myself an analogy, is it's like you have the engine to push whatever the number is, 450, whatever this number is, but you need to work on the transmission now. You need to teach the muscles how to fire at a different speed.
Does that
make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's definitely true. That's why when in the past they call it race rhythm, okay? I miss race rhythm. So you miss that souplesse, that ability to spin the legs, basically, you know, to be efficient and the higher cadence with a very quick contraction, okay? Very quick. So the muscles stay contracted for a very short time. And I have to say, it is different. But once you're racing, there shouldn't be any difference between climb and flat power. Once you train both, or you do both. If you always train on the climb at 80 RPM, then you go on the flat. It's gonna be hard to, because also it's also the position is different. But it's exactly like you said, the transmission to be efficient at that power out because. Because, on a climb, maybe that's 20 minutes, you can also do 80 RPM. But on the flat, it's 4 hours, you know. And so you cannot go 80. You also need to respond quickly to acceleration. And if you go at 90, 95, it's easier for you to do that, you know.
Okay. And then so how do you train this? Because now in time trials, they go so fast. Like there's guys, like they're going, like getting close to 60 kilometers an hour. And like how do you, nobody's doing that in training. So what are guys doing? Like do some guys go training with disc wheels and TT helmets on, like race setups or?
No, you know, in training you do that. You don't really do that in training. You don't do that in training. You do that through races.
Okay, but like if you're targeting,
so, and then also actually a pro, I'm not saying doesn't need to train there, but you are racing from January to October, and then they take a break of 15 days, and they are on the bike. They never lose that. Mm-hmm. They never lose that.
Okay.
So you know you need to train there when you are off for 3 months for an injury, but you don't really not necessarily need to train that. So if you don't race for 3 months, okay, but you know if you train on the flat, you train there with cadence. You can also you can use transmission. Okay, you can do that on the climb too. Okay, just on a shallow climb, you go 100 RPM. You can do mm-hmm. that.
Okay,
you can train, but it's so. I remember when I was, when I was still racing, there was this motor pacing train. Motor pace is a good way to train that, but it's very dangerous to do in some part because of the traffic. So I would not encourage someone doing that because of that. Okay.
Okay.
I mean, if you really have the possibility, it's a very good training because it gives you that inertia, that stimulus. And constant load on the pedals, okay. But I mean, if you after 3-4 race days, you would be okay.
Sure,
it would be okay.
Okay, so back to the initial question, I guess. Then the three sessions that you would do the most if you're targeting the Olympics, 3 months leading out to it. So there's torque efforts. We talked a little bit about that.
Yeah.
What would be the next two workouts you would do?
Well, I told you the race pace efforts. Okay, building the power. Building towards the power, so
right.
The extensive, and then the first section is probably a session based about being able to hold I would say because he's talking about Olympic gear, we're talking about a develop ride. He's able to hold the position. Okay, the first session it would be aimed to do specific session leading up to the race. Okay, so race day simulation. That's what I would do.
Ah, so you go through like the nutrition, everything.
So warm up, nutrition, everything lined up. You know, plan the nutrition, plan the warm up, plan the do it all out effort. Maybe not similar, but do something like this. And how do you feel during just before? Okay. That can happen in a you take a race, B race. Okay, let's plan this. Take it easy the first 2 days before, but that would be also in training something like a race day simulation. Yeah, because that's you cannot just go there in the Olympic Games and never having tried the protocol in the same situation, and it cannot be during a stage race because otherwise it's different. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
You need to do. That's why I think if I have to prepare a time trial. At the Olympic day, I wouldn't do Olympic Tour de France or any race in the 4 weeks leading up to the event. I wouldn't do that because that's where you need to train all the small details.
Right. So what are some of the other small details that you do on race day that you need to practice because you don't normally do them in training? Like the one that comes to mind, like, okay, the warm-up is one thing, but whatever you're planning on eating, but like some guys like bicarb, like using bicarb before the time trials. What do you think about this kind of stuff?
Yeah, you have to try. I think for bikers works really well for some riders in some events. So you need to try in training or in a race competition. You need to try before training or race. You need to try before, and then see if you digest it. So that's one of the things. It's biker whatever, and also it's the gen you take during the race. Normally you don't take during the race, but before the race, all the nutrition stuff. And in nutrition, I count also biker
Do you find that works?
Beetroot juice.
Do you find that works, or is that just a placebo?
Well, it's very difficult to measure. Yeah. Very difficult to measure because probably very elite athletes with a very high view through doesn't. It's very difficult to measure a difference.
Okay,
but it is not harming. It's not hurting. So yeah, with elite athletes, it can work with the, but we need to probably lower. I mean, it's not enough. Just take one or two shots a day, race day. You need to load
for
days in advance.
Days before. Okay. How about strength training in the gym? Do you do this with your riders?
Yeah. Do this for, I mean, especially in the winter, and then maintenance work during all the season, depending on the race schedule. But no, I cannot tell you they do one session every week, because it's not like that. But they might do three sessions in 2 weeks when they have they don't have a race day,
yep.
Race, or then they have 3 weeks of races and they have no session there.
So which exercises?
So we try to include it.
Which exercises?
These very simple exercises. You know, if they're able to do the squat on the, you know, on a, that would be
the
enough.
Squat, barbell squat.
Barbell squat. That would be enough. Barbell, or the leg press, or you know, step up, or all the stuff. I like to train. I like the writer to do the kinetic chain training. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the step up, the squat involves all the kinetic chain, and. That would be enough for me, just for increased efficiency, what we're talking about. Very few exercises, very focused. And then the all maintenance work about the core training, you know, this under big umbrella of core training, just to keep the person very, very fit and very solid as an athlete. Okay. As an athlete, okay? But for second, you know, keep it simple, squat on a... Yeah, leg press if they are not able, because sometimes, because you need to overload, and so you want heavy weights. Not all riders without the system are able to do the squats properly, or the risk of getting injured is there. So you just go for the safe way and do the press.
Okay.
And I find very helpful for. And then there's a difference if you work with a climber or with a sprinter in the load. The principle more or less are the same.
Okay. How many reps do the guys typically do? What is the rep range?
Well, the rep range can be from 5 to 20.
Okay.
Yeah, because 5, when it's you really work on maximum strength, you go down to 5 reps, 4 sets of 5, and then, but at the beginning of the season, the dangerous phase, especially as a climber, the climber might not even ride to that. So if you, you know, a 60-kilo skinny guy, they just do maybe go down to 8 reps, something like this.
Okay. And then here's a really controversial question. Do you do the gym training before or after training on the bike?
My question doesn't matter as long as they do.
Okay.
But if I my preference would be separate them by 2.5 hours. Okay. It's 4, it's better. Gym in the afternoon and endurance training in the morning.
Okay, cool, very cool.
But I just say, the gym, I can do gym on in the morning. Fine, I mean, we have not. Just more important that they do in a good physiological state, so they don't go to the gym starving.
Yeah.
They need to go to the gym with energy. With legs full of glycogen. That's why I said go in the morning, do that, and then have a good meal, proper nap, and then go in the afternoon when the hormones are at its peak.
I see. Okay. All right. Well, that's a great way to end it. We'll leave it there. Hey, guys. I hope you enjoyed geeking out on all that training science as much as I did. I'd been talking to Marco for years, just asking him specific questions. He was short on time, so I'll try to get another one done with him in the future because I really enjoyed that. And if you love this content, you can find tons more and my books at howtobecomeaprocyclist.com. All right. Bye, everybody.